Welcome to the 5th Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a senior fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by James Henderson, who's director of the Natural Gas Program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies Natural Gas Program, to discuss the paper, The Spymex Gas Exchange, Russian Gas Trading Possibilities, that was published on the 22nd of January 2018, on which James authored in cooperation with Patrick Heather of the OIES and Tatiana Matrova and her colleagues at the Skolkovo Energy Centre in Moscow. Jim, great to have you here.
Thank you very much, David,
for joining us. James, you know, in your paper, it starts by outlining the general theory behind the pricing of commodities, and in particular, the perceived peculiarities of gas, addressing the basic pricing structural question, what should gas prices reflect? So I was just wondering, why is this so applicable to Russia?
That's a very interesting question, David. And I think the answer is that gas as a commodity, obviously, there's two ways of pricing it, either in a free market way that we're used to in Europe, or via state control. And of course, as we came out of the Soviet era, which had been very much about state control, and moved into the post-Soviet era in Russia, there was a big question about how the benefits of gas, which as a commodity is much more of a natural monopoly than, say, oil or coal because of the issues around transportation, how gas should be priced, one, to maximise the efficiency of the industry, but two, obviously, to provide benefits to the economy and the people of Russia.
Right, so that's sharing. That's the economic rent sharing, is it?
Exactly. So how to distribute the rent from the gas industry. And in a classical model, one might allow prices to be set by the market, but then distribute the rent via taxation.
Yeah.
But obviously, in a more state-controlled environment, one can use, you know, things like subsidized pricing to ensure that both industry and the population aren't undermined by a monopoly producer. And of course, as we came into the post-Soviet era, Gazprom emerged essentially as the owner of all the gas assets, or pretty much all the gas assets in Russia. It evolved out of the Ministry of Gas, and therefore the natural way for things to progress in Russia was via state control and the regulation of prices to ensure that in the first years of the post-Soviet era, there was not a dramatic increase in prices, which obviously could have occurred because of Gazprom's monopoly over the system.
But that raises an interesting question about what the role of Gazprom is, because on one hand, they're being asked to have low prices for the reasons you've discussed. And on the other hand, of course, they have to invest in new upstream gas supply. So how do you balance that?
Well, I think that was the very interesting question that was emerged over the first decade of the post-Soviet era. Initially, of course, Gazprom inherited assets from the Ministry of Gas from the Soviet era, in which it had invested essentially nothing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the economic rent, quite justifiably, should be shared amongst the Russian people. And so therefore, low regulated prices allowed the Russian economy and the Russian population to benefit from that inheritance, if you like. And Gazprom, as we all remember, made most of its money in any case from export sales.
Yeah.
But of course, the question you ask is a very valid one. As those Soviet era fields started to go into decline, and Gazprom needed to invest in new fields, and also as the question of the optimal balance between the domestic market and the export market became more of a question as gas demand in Europe started to rise and demand for Russian exports started to rise, then, of course, the question of what's the optimal level for domestic prices became a much more relevant question, because not only did Gazprom need more revenues to invest in its fields, but also it needed to balance the needs of the domestic market versus the needs of the export market. And if low prices are encouraging higher domestic demand, then obviously that undermines your export sales.
And of course, one of the other things that you start to see now is increased domestic competition from independent companies as well, giving additional supply. And that combined with economic stagnation, not to mention the exchange rate weakness due to the economic sanctions. This has changed the outlook since 2014. So how has Gazprom reacted to that?
Well, I think essentially what happened in stages, really from the end of the 1990s through to the 2010s, was that the issues that you raised about Gazprom needing to reinvest became more urgent, and Gazprom therefore encouraged the Russian government to increase regulated prices towards a level where it could make some kind of return on its new investments. Mm-hmm. And that process really carried on through the 2000s, and the Russian government started to set various targets for domestic prices, for example, in the mid-2000s, linked to net back parity, which was the export market, in
sort
a sense.
Primarily the European market,
where prices were being set by oil prices. And so in 2005-2006, when the oil price was about $60, there was a target set for gas prices to reach net back parity by 2012, which implied a price of around $100 to $120 per 1,000 cubic metres in Russia, which was a level at which Gazprom could essentially make a rate of return on its new field investments. Now, what happened as those prices were gradually implemented was that the oil price rose, so the export net back parity target kind of went out of the window. But nevertheless, regulated prices rose to a level at which Gazprom could start to break even on its domestic sales, having been loss-making before. But also, of course, as it became profitable domestically, so naturally other players found that they could produce gas.
I want a part of it.
And make money as well. The natural sort of market forces basically came into play, because it's very important to know that regulated prices in Russia only apply to Gazprom.
Right.
And so third-party players can sell at whatever price they're right. Now, historically, of course, regulated prices were very low to allow the distribution of rents to the population and to the economy. But and so, naturally, third-party producers were not incentivized to sell much gas. As soon as the regulated price reached a level at which it was economically justifiable to invest, of course, Gazprom invested and everyone else invested.
And so
you increase supply. And essentially, by 2012, it became apparent that there was going to be significant competition. And indeed, third parties like Novatek and Rosneft started to sign contracts with consumers at a discount to the regulated price, and they could still make money. It was quite clear from their profitability that they were making money. And at that point, it became clear that we'd sort of reached some kind of equilibrium price in the market. And at that point, the regulated the growth in the regulated price started to slow down dramatically. For that reason, and also because of various other economic reasons, obviously the economic crisis post-2009, the economic problems post-sanctions in 2014, also a catalyst. But nevertheless, the market appeared to have found an equilibrium price. And at that point, the question of how you actually find out what the optimal price is became a real question between, you know, state control. You know, it is the state wise enough to be able to set a regulated price that makes sense? Or at that point, do you start to look for market mechanisms to help you, you know, find what that optimal equilibrium price is?
Well, before we talk about SPYMEX, which is why we're here to talk about the paper, can we just step back a bit to one of the earlier vestiges of a trading platform? I think it was back in, back in 2002. You know, Gazprom had the right to purchase from independent producers at market price, and there was this electronic trading platform set up at that time. And I just wonder, was that a success? And how's that? And how's the kind of the process towards market-based pricing happened since then? Or didn't it work?
Essentially, what happened was, you know, as I've described, Gazprom needed more gas to meet its demand. Third parties had, at that stage, largely associated gas being produced with their oil, and Gazprom wanted a mechanism to access that gas. And obviously, the producers themselves, mainly the oil companies, wanted actually to monetize their gas reserves. And
your paper does say that Gazprom was reluctant to allow the full force of the market to operate, even though, of course, the consumers, it would have provided a significant benefit. So I'm just wondering, you know, what's changed?
So, essentially, initially what happened was that Gazprom set up via Mezregion Gas, its domestic marketing subsidiary, its own electronic platform, which allowed third parties to come and sell gas to Gazprom.
To Gazprom. Okay.
And that was it. Gazprom would
sell. So it wasn't really an exchange. It was just a way
they
mechanism.
They called it electronic trading platform. Okay. I mean, that ETP. So essentially it was a way, and it was an experiment. It was a three-year experiment to see whether Gazprom could access gas at market prices, inverted commas market prices, from third parties. It worked to an extent. It was a very small part of the overall volumes.
Right.
But it was an initial kind of attempt, which then moved into a second attempt at developing a broader trading platform, where the government started to step in and mandate certain volumes that would be traded will be contributed by Gazprom and third parties on a 50-50 basis.
Right.
And that ran from 2005 until 2008.
Right.
And at that point, the kind of the experiment, if you like, came to an end because there were various disagreements about how trading should carry on. And it was clear, obviously, that, that Gazprom asking for it to be 50-50 between Gazprom and third parties was difficult.
Yeah.
And then the economic crisis hit and various other things kind of caused a delay.
Right.
So from 2008 onwards, it kind of went into abeyance for three or four years.
Well, why don't we move on specifically now and talk about the St. Petersburg International Mercantile Exchange, SPYMEX, which, of course, trades refined products, crude oil, timber, as well as natural gas, which I think it started trading on October 14, 2019. How does the gas trading contract work?
Well, essentially, there are two contracts, a day ahead and month ahead.
Yeah.
SPYMEX was set up in 2014, encouraged by the government. Gazprom wanted to restart its own exchange, but the government was very keen that there should be a kind of third-party commodity exchange. Again, the volumes that are mandated to pass through the exchange have been increasing. Theoretically, it is still a 50-50, so increased from 5 BCM from Gazprom and third parties to 10, and then in 2017 to 17.5 BCM from each party. That gas is brought to the exchange and is traded really on an OTC basis and bilateral trade. So essentially you bring your gas to the exchange, customers come and buy that gas, and then they have to physically take it away and use it.
But that's only gas produced directly by the supplier, isn't it?
Indeed. So essentially all that's happening is that it is an OTC, it's a way of buyer and seller being put together, but with no retrading, no real trading going on. It's
so
just
the purchaser must take it, they can't untrade it.
No, exactly. Okay, one of the big issues is that there is no resale of excess gas.
Okay.
So it's a very simplistic model for the time being. As I say, for day ahead and month ahead trading, there are four hubs based at four compressor stations around Russia. There's one hub in West Siberia, trading point in West Siberia at Nadym, which where the vast majority of the volume is traded because it's closest to the production area.
Okay.
So a lot of trading carries on there. Most of the gas is contributed by Gazprom still, so Gazprom accounts for more than 80% of the gas that is traded on the exchange, and third parties do bring gas. Rosneft and Novatek do sell gas on the exchange, but to a much more limited extent. So, for example, this year, Gazprom will probably trade its 17.5 BCM. The third parties will do probably no more than 5 or 6 BCM. So it's still very much dominated by Gazprom.
Well, about 87%, I read in your paper in 2017.
By the first 9 months of the year, it was about 87%.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's certainly dominated by
Gazprom. It sounds to me like it's very restrictive. It really does. And I'm just wondering, particularly with the need to have pipeline access agreed with Gazprom in advance of trade being completed, together with Gazprom actually being the commodity delivery operator for gas to SPYMEX, hasn't Gazprom got a preferred trading position?
Well, it has, and of course, it has the vast majority of the reserves in Russia.
Mm.
It has the vast majority of the surplus of the reserves in Russia. So it has the gas to trade, and of course, addressing that issue is a big issue for Russia, full stop. And indeed, many people would argue that the SPYMEX exchange can really only work fully if there is actually institutional change in the Russian gas sector. And it's one of the interesting things about analysing the SPYMEX gas exchange is that the implications of it working actually are very large implications to the Russian gas sector.
So you think it could be a catalyst to change the structure of the Russian gas industry?
Well, essentially, and we'll come to the conclusions, at the end. But, I mean, I think it's a relatively binary moment. I mean, if the SPYMEX exchange is going to work, the implications are for fairly significant change in the Russian gas sector as a whole. If there is not fairly significant change in the Russian gas sector as a whole, then essentially SPYMEX may end up just fading away into obscurity.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, SPYMEX has been in existence, for 3 years?
3 years.
And I think probably the question is, how is it doing? What is its liquidity like? And how many companies are participating in the exchange? It sounds to me like there's not many.
Well, I think that again, good question. Perhaps we've been a little bit negative about the SPYMEX exchange. And I think the point to make is it has only been going for 3 years. You know, Patrick Heather, our colleague at Oxford, has written extensively about the hubs in Europe and has made the point that, you know, it takes a good 10 to 15 years, even in relatively mature markets, to get, you know, hubs really going. So, no, SPYMEX has taken the first few steps down the road. And for Russia, that is, you know, a significant move forward.
Yeah.
How many people trade? So there's five regular sellers. Gazprom dominates, Rosneft and Novatek. Two or three other smaller traders come. In terms of customers, there are actually between 60 and 70 fairly regular customers.
Well, that's
now,
not,
you know, again, one has to caveat that.
Mm-hmm.
Mesregion Gas, the Gazprom subsidiary, it has a significant number of regional subsidiaries.
Right.
They account for probably 40 to 50% of trading mm-hmm. in 2017. So Gazprom is a seller. Gazprom subsidiaries are buyers. Again, it highlights the issue that Gazprom is obviously the major gas player in Russia.
But there are historical reasons for that.
But of course. And so, you know, that, you know, above and beyond that, Rosneft and Novatek buy gas as well as sell it because mm-hmm. they need to supplement their own gas supply to meet contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Companies like NL Russia and Eurochem, big industrial consumers, yep. they buy gas on the exchange. So a market has developed. And if one looks at the way volumes move and prices move, there is clear seasonality in the trading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prices dip in the summer and they rise in winter, as you would expect. Interestingly, volumes of third-party gas rise in summer for sale because obviously in the summer they've got spare capacity. In the winter they are fully contracted,
mm-hmm.
Given the flexibility within their contracts. But so there are clearly limitations.
Mm-hmm.
One of the limitations is that, you know, Novatek and Rosneft need to continue to increase gas production to have enough gas to mm-hmm. supply their customers. But, you know, one is seeing elements of a market develop.
Yeah.
One would not call it in any sense a European-style trading hub yet,
yeah.
but it has taken the first steps down the road.
Now, you mentioned Patrick Heather's 2015 OIS paper, The Evolution of European Traded Gas Hubs, which, by the way, is available for download. Anybody listen to this podcast. And just picking up on that then, you know, when do you think that it will be able to claim? When do you think SPYMEX will be able to claim to be a fully functioning exchange? Is it going to be the 10 to 15 years which Patrick talks about in his paper?
Well, I think it is going to take that long. And I think, you know, that there are a number of issues to address. I think perhaps it's interesting to kind of compare TTF,
mm-hmm.
You know, probably the most liquid hub in Europe with SPYMEX. You know, TTF has 40 active traders, sellers, when measured by the various categories like the tradability index, where you know, on a scale of 1 to 20, TTF ranks at the highest level of 20 because of the spreads and the amount of gas you can trade over on the futures and derivatives, but also in over the time series out many years, you know, and in terms of its churn rate. Measuring, you know, the volumes of trading versus the volumes passing through the system, you know, TTF is clearly in a league of its own.
Absolutely.
SPYMEX's tradability index is almost unmeasurable. Its churn ratio is, well, if you're being kind, it's one. If you're being unkind, it's like 0.1.
Yeah.
So, you know, SPYMEX is a long, long way behind. And I've mentioned the number of people bringing gas exchanges, kind of 5 or 6 versus 40 on TTF. Having said that, you know, this is because there are significant institutional barriers within the Russian system which make it very difficult to trade. One of them is this inability to resell gas.
Yep.
Another is the fact that that there is still an attempt, you know, in order to avoid Gazprom domination, to have a 50-50 split, to limit the amount of gas that Gazprom can bring. Now, there is a big debate at the moment about whether Gazprom should be allowed to sell more gas on the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
There is an inherent risk in that, of course, of it basically dominating prices, but mm-hmm. that would potentially increase the volumes. And the third major issue is the transport system, where, as you've mentioned, although third parties have access to the transport system, they have to negotiate in advance, and they don't actually know the full tariff they're going to get charged because of the way the tariff system works. It's not clear exactly what your transport fee will be.
You do mention the possibility, you know, maybe one solution could be the creation of a virtual hub or hubs around which trading could take place. You know, could that improve the current situation?
Well, I think it could. I mean, at the moment, the hubs, as I said, or the main trading hub is the compressor station in West Siberia, which is convenient for the producers. But as I said, you know, that then transporting the gas from that hub to the consumers, There is an element of uncertainty about what the exact transport cost will be because ultimately, to balance the system, Gazprom chooses its optimal route.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a virtual trading hub which was closer to the consumers and from which there were agreed transportation, fixed transportation tariffs for distances from that virtual trading point, then it would become much clearer as to what the actual final cost of the gas would be
less once opaque.
You
were
less opaque, exactly that. You know, clearly there needs to be other adaptations to the system. The resale of gas is another big issue that needs to be addressed. If you purchase too much gas, or if you have contracted too much gas under a long-term contract with either Gazprom or Rosneft or any of the others, you need to be able to resell that gas on the exchange. That's a fundamental point that needs to be addressed as well.
I would like to address part of your paper. You actually carried out a confidential survey of 20 actors, as you call them. I like that expression, actors, who either use the SpyMix gas exchange actively or act as regulators or commentators. And I know that this is a confidential survey, but I wonder whether you could share with us what the key conclusions were.
Well, the key conclusions were that although SpyMix does act as a quasi market of sorts and does allow customers to buy gas over and above what they have contracted, it has significant limitations. I mean, you know, the most cynical of those interviewed would say it's not a market at all, it's dominated by Gazprom and its development is over. But I think the most interesting conclusions were that, as we discuss in the paper, the outcome is relatively binary, because if SpyMix is going to address the issues of transportation, of virtual hubs, of Gazprom dominance, then, as one interviewee said, in Europe what happened was the third energy package. And what Russia needs is its own first energy package, which addresses all the issues of third-party access, of market dominance by one actor, of the interaction between upstream, midstream and downstream, and breaking those links, and allowing full competition. Now, so clearly the future of SpyMix is linked to the future of the institutional arrangement within the Russian gas sector as a whole, and that is the most interesting thing about it. I mean, following volumes traded, following monthly prices, is provides a certain level of interest. I mean, prices are at a slight discount to the regulated price at the moment, and it's always interesting to note that and to sort of see how customers can benefit from that. But in really going forward, if a forward curve is to be developed, if futures and derivatives are to be developed, if customers are going to be encouraged to trade more, then we need to see real institutional change. And SpyMix will either catalyse that, or SpyMix will just fade away.
So there's two end games. I'll come to the end game at the end of the interview, because I'd like to figure out. But I just like, before we do that, I'd like to ask a very fundamental question. You know, in the future, could European gas buyers be buying gas from Gazprom? And maybe other Russian gas producers and traders on SpyMix based on price in the future? You know, do you think that's going to happen? Do you think that would be welcomed by the European Commission?
Well, I think, obviously, the location of the St. Petersburg Exchange at one end of the Nord Stream pipeline leads to the obvious conclusion that it could, in the fullness of time, become an interesting trading hub. The fact that there is a debate over the legal position of Nord Stream, particularly Nord Stream 2, in terms of third-party access, the third energy package, you know, clearly one way of resolving that would be to allow third parties to transport gas through Nord Stream 2. How would they access that gas is an open question, but clearly in the fullness of time, an exchange or a hub at St. Petersburg could be the answer to that, and SpyMix could be one foundational catalyst of that. I would caveat that by saying we're a long, long way away from that right now. I mean, there's no way that European customers are going to be confident trading on the SpyMix as it currently stands. But following the developments of SpyMix, you know, again, in tandem with the developments around Nord Stream 2 and Gazprom's interactions with the European Commission and with third-party actors in Europe, I think is an interesting thing to do, because the potential is clearly there, and the potential for the interaction between the European price and the domestic Russian price, which President Putin talked about as long ago as 2005 in terms of netback parity. You know, clearly there is the potential there. Prices are not miles away at the moment. Netback parity price is still slightly higher than domestic price, but nevertheless, the opportunity for trading is clearly there. It's not going to happen in the next couple of years.
So okay, but so your paper concludes with the two possible outcomes, and so we haven't got long to say. But you know, what do you think these are, and how is it going to play out?
Well, I think you know the the question of the outcome for Spimex in terms of being linked to the European export market is clearly linked to Gazprom's monopoly of export pipelines, which is a debate that has fluctuated over the last 3 to 5 years. The most recent statements from the Energy Ministry have been that it's not something that's going to happen in the foreseeable future, and even Rosneft have stepped back a bit from being too aggressive. Now, I think there's a political element to that, because ahead of the presidential elections in March, there was never going to be...
But you have seen the monopoly on LNG exports has been removed.
Exactly. So it's a natural consequence that may take some time. So I think, therefore, that kind of link with the European market via Nord Stream is something we're talking about in the mid-2020s at the earliest. However, in a domestic market context, I think that there are other interesting questions that the Spimex debate raises around the transport monopoly that Gazprom enjoys. For a long time, it's been argued, in fact, it was part of Russian government policy, that ultimately prices would be liberalised and that the government would control the gas sector as they do the oil sector via the pipeline system, which would imply the actual physical or accounting breakup of Gazprom. Now, if Spimex is the gas exchange is going to work, something like that ultimately does have to happen. And so I think that, in the next couple of years, once the presidential elections are out the way, once that debate can restart, then we may see, a more active move towards, as I say, regulation of some parts of the gas sector and more competition in other parts. And that will be fairly radical, but it's not inconceivable. And I think, following what happens around the Spimex gas exchange is going to be one indicator of which way the wind is blowing, if you like, in Russia. So it's the paper does not set out to sort of come up with some kind of radical forecast, but it does say, clearly there's been movement towards a market-based pricing system. It's gradual movement. But if we continue to see more movement, then the implications of the Russian gas sector as a whole are fairly fundamental.
Well, that's quite a positive note, I have to say. And, James, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation and also reading your great paper, The Spimex Gas Exchange, Russia Gas Trading Possibilities, that, can I remind you, can be found on our website, www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you again, and goodbye to everyone.